today, you know, Mayor Burka was speaking on the strength of the null singularity inside black holes.
Classical general relativity fails at curvature singularities. It is intriguing that there are two distinct ways in which GR fails at two different types of singularities. The well-known way is at space-like singularities, where the failure is through infinite destructive tidal forces. But in the last decade, there has been accumulating evidence that there is another type of black hole singularity, which is still scalar polynomial in the sense that Riemann square diverges, but it is null rather than space-like, and weak in the sense that tidal distortions are finite rather than unbounded. The evidence for this new picture of a black hole singularity arises from many independent approaches. First, there is linear and nonlinear perturbation analysis, which have been done both for a spherical black hole and for a spinning black hole. And it has been shown that there is local existence and genericity in the sense of functional genericity of the null singularity in several cases. There's been approximate leading order analysis, also both for spherical charged black holes and for spinning black holes, and lastly, fully nonlinear numerical analysis only in the spherical charged case. Let us consider the model of a spherical charged black hole perturbed nonlinearly by self-gravitating minimally coupled massless scalar field. For this model, the basic properties of the space-time structure were found numerically, first by Brady and Smith and later by other workers. It was demonstrated that the inner horizon is converted into a null singularity. So in this Penrose diagram, this is the event horizon of the black hole and this is future null infinity. This would have been the inner horizon of the Reisner-Nordström black hole, but because of the nonlinear scalar field, it evolves into a null singularity. At this singularity, the mass function diverges, and because the curvature is related directly to the mass function, also the curvature diverges. You see here the log of the local mass function is a function of advanced time or of the ingoing Eddington coordinate, and it is easily shown that it grows exponentially. The singularity is located here at infinite value of V. Despite that, the area coordinate is finite, and it decreases monotonically with retarded time in that direction. So at any point along the singularity, we have a finite value of the area coordinate, but this coordinate decreases monotonically along the singularity. And lastly, you can find coordinates for which all metric coefficients and also the metric determinant are finite at the inner horizon. So the area coordinate is one of those coordinates. The other coordinate, the GUV metric function, is displayed here again as a function of advanced time, and it approaches the solid line here, a constant value as V approaches infinity. for the general spherically symmetric line element can be written in the following way. We have a GUV metric function and the area coordinate. And let us consider the class of perturbations which is inherent to any gravitational collapse process, and in this sense it is generic. These perturbations of the scalar field decay along the event horizon as an inverse power of advanced time, where n is some integer which is related to the multiple moment in question. Next, let us define a Kruskal-Lie coordinate as function of advanced time in the usual sense. For this class of perturbation, it was shown that the gradients of the area coordinate and of the scalar field behave in the following way. We have here some constant which is defined uniquely only in terms of the external properties of the black hole. They are both inversely proportional to R and to the Kruskal-Lie coordinate V. Here we have some negative power of log V and 1 plus higher order terms. The interesting thing about these expressions is that first they are valid anywhere along the singularity, both at late time where nonlinear effects are crucial, such that it is valid anywhere along the singularity. Second, these gradients are exactly inversely proportional to 1 over R. Namely, if we consider 2 points on this singularity and consider the ratio of R, V, or phi, V for these 2 points on the singularity, then all factors here cancel out except the 1 over R. So in this sense, because R is a monotonically decreasing function along the singularity, R, V and phi, V grow exactly proportionally to 1 over R on the singularity. What I should do next is to discuss the strength of the singularity. In particular, I will show that it is weak according to the Tipler classification of strengths of singularities. Let us consider the following definition for Tipler strong singularity. Let us consider a non-space-like geodesic which runs into the singularity, so it can be any causal curve which runs into the singularity. Now, for each such curve, we can define three independent Jacobi fields, that is, fields which are defined by the equation of geodesic deviation. These Jacobi fields induce a special metric, a free metric, from which we can calculate the volume element. Now, if this volume element vanishes as one approaches the singularity along every such non-space-like geodesic, then the singularity is strong in the Tipler sense. The physical content of this singularity is that all extended physical objects are necessarily crushed to zero volume as they hit the singularity. So the strategy for the demonstration that the singularity is Tipler weak is to show that the necessary condition for the singularity to be Tipler strong is not satisfied. And therefore, because it is a singularity, it has to be Tipler weak. This condition is given by a theorem by Clark and Kolak, which is the following. If you consider tethered components of the Riemann tensor, then for at least one such component, if we integrate it twice with respect to proper time or a fine parameter, and the result of these two integrations does not converge at the singularity, then the singularity is Tipler strong. So what we need to do is to build the components of the Riemann tensor. Luckily, we can build the Riemann tensor only with gradients of the area coordinates and the scalar field, we don't need the gradient of the GUV metric function for that. And the reason is quite interesting. The Riemann tensor can be written as a sign of two tensors. One is the Weyl tensor, and the other one is a second tensor, which is built from the Ricci tensor and from the metric tensor. The Weyl tensor in spherical symmetry is given completely by the mass function, but the mass function involves only derivatives of the area coordinate, but not the metric function. So the Weyl tensor doesn't include any contribution from gradients of the GUV metric function. The other tensor is the Ricci tensor. And the Ricci tensor is, for a scalar field in spherical symmetry, is just twice the product of two gradients of the scalar field, which also does not include gradients of the GUV metric function. And therefore, the Riemann tensor is independent of gradients of GUV. Now, the components of Riemann which have the strong divergence are the components which have two V indices, either this component or this component. All other components of Riemann have weaker divergences than these. And it is easy to show if we just take the above expression for the gradients of the scalar field, that near the horizon, these components of Riemann, which I, for brevity, denote here but just R, have the following behavior. Now, because both metric functions are finite at the singularity, transforming to a parallelly propagated frame, namely to the tetrad components of this components of Riemann tensor, does not change this functional dependence, but just some finite multiplicative factors, but not this dependence on Z. The next element which we need in the demonstration is that if you transform this to a function of proper time or a fine parameter, and this is done by solving the geodesic equations and finding V as a function of proper time. Unfortunately, to do that, we have the logarithmic derivative of the GUV metric function in the geodesic equations. So even though we didn't need them until now, we have to find this expression for the logarithmic derivative of GUV. For this, we use the Einstein equation for the spherically symmetric Einstein scalar equations. And this expression is equal to the logarithmic derivative of R, V plus another term which is proportional to phi, V squared. So we write this term as logarithmic gradient of the logarithmic derivative, and we just compute from the expressions we already have for phi, V and R, V this term and write it here. So this is trivial to integrate this. So log V is just the log of the product of these factors, which is V an integration constant, V times R, V, times this logarithmic function, which has here the coefficients of the second order terms in the solution for R, V and phi, V. In R, V and phi, V, B1 and C1 are the coefficients of the second order terms, and these are crucial for the solution. Higher order terms turn out to be unimportant. And if we just exponentiate both sides of this equation, we find the GUV metric function, which is given by this expression, and if we substitute for R, V the expression we already have, we find this. Now, from the numerical simulations, which I showed you earlier, we know that GUV metric function has to be finite at the event horizon. Therefore, this exponent has to vanish. So we have the constraint that this relation of the second order coefficients has to be equal to 2n plus 2, because this is the only solution which will be consistent with the results of the numerical simulations. And we can also find explicitly that the logarithmic derivative of the GUV metric function grows exactly like 1 over r squared when we advance along the singularity. So we can now substitute this into the geodesic equation, and it can be easily shown that V of tau is to leading order in 1 over log V proportional to the proper time or to a fun parameter. So we can, in fact, if we consider higher order terms here, then V of tau is not an analytic function. But it can still be expanded in powers of 1 over log V, even though not in power of V. But as long as we are interested only in V of tau or its first derivative with respect to tau, this approximation of V of tau approximately equal to tau is a fairly good approximation. If we need second order derivatives, then this approximation is of no use, and we have to consider also higher order terms here. But luckily, we need only the V of tau itself, not even its first derivative, so we can just substitute tau for V. Therefore, the typical tethered components of the Riemann tensor behave like 1 over tau squared times this logarithmic factor. And what we need to do now is to integrate this twice with respect to proper time or fine parameter, and this is trivially done, and we find that this is finite as tau approaches 0. Consequently, a necessary condition for any causal geodesic to terminate at a tipless strong singularity is not satisfied. This means that all causal geodesics terminate at a tipler weak singularity, or in other words, that the singularity itself is tipler weak. This result is valid everywhere along the singularity. We didn't use any perturbative analysis or any expansion near the causal asymptotic path of the singularity, so this is valid anywhere, in particular at late retarded times where we expect nonlinear effects to be important. Thank you. Okay, if you mean this integration?
Yeah.
Okay, what you should put here is the Riemann tensor. Now, this is the leading order in powers of 1 over log V. All higher order terms have even weaker divergence than this.
Oh,
I agree that you need to think on the convergence of the series. Now, if this is just a simple series in log tau, then I believe that convergence is guaranteed, but this needs to be checked.
Other questions?
Yeah, what can you say about the intersection there to the space-like part,
this
and the null part? Is that exclusively from the numerical studies?
Yes. No, there is some analytic evidence in terms of a simplified quasi-homogeneous model for this space-like singularity. And this, but because it is a homogeneous model, you cannot distinguish between different points along this space like singularity. So all is currently known about this point is only from numerical simulations, and what can be shown is that if you approach this point along this space-like singularity, then you have a Tipler strong singularity at any point, but in some sense, a strong singularity which is getting weaker. And this is matched by a weak singularity which gets stronger. This growing strength of the singularity is manifested by the behavior of the gradients, which I was showing, the r, v and phi, v terms which grow like 1 over r, or the logarithmic derivative of the GUP metric function, which grows like 1 over r squared. So the singularity is weak anywhere, but getting stronger. The singularity here is strong and getting weaker, and here they somehow match, but there is still no analytic model to explain that.
Would you expect anything similar at all for a Schwarzschild black hole as opposed to a Russell-Wolff?
Well, for a Schwarzschild black hole, there is no null singularity.
You really expect to stay one?
Yes. But still, a Schwarzschild black hole is really a class of measure zero because it doesn't have spin. But the singularity inside Schwarzschild, or even perturbed Schwarzschild, something which will asymptotically become Schwarzschild, is known to be only space-like.
Would you expect that new singularities to appear in the collapse of
You can start with regular initial data if you consider, for example, the collapse of a charged, electrically charged scalar field. Hodet Piran found recently in numerical simulations that if you start with regular initial data, you don't have already a black hole on the initial slice, and you consider the collapse of a charged scalar field, you will find out internal structure which is very similar to this one.
Other questions? Thank all our speakers.